Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this podcast early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Fall of Rome. As always, I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thank you for joining me today. Sometime in the turbulent 490s, as the story goes, the Frankish king Clovis was reviewing his soldiers before they embarked on yet another campaign of conquest. Clovis walked up and down, checking weapons and armor, and then stopped in front of one man, a man he remembered from an incident some years before. During a raiding expedition to Soissons in northern Gaul, this man had taken a ewer, a jug, that Clovis had wanted for himself, and this man had split it in two with his axe. Within a warband that functioned on the equitable distribution of plunder, this man was saying even the king didn't have the right to take what he wanted. So Clovis steps in front of this fella, and he grabs the man's axe. It was in disgraceful condition, he said, and tossed it on the ground. When the man bent down to pick it up, Clovis pulled out his own axe and split the man's skull in two. "This is what you did to my ewer at Soissons," Clovis said. I suspect the rest of his soldiers got the message. Is the story true? Did this really happen? We have no idea. It comes to us from the later historian Gregory of Tours, who was well informed about the events of his own day a century later, but much less so about those events in Clovis's time. What we know of Clovis during his actual lifetime is pretty limited, but there's no doubting, based on what we do know, that he was savvy, politically astute, and utterly ruthless. Whatever its origins, it stands to reason that this incident reflects the later understanding of Clovis, a towering figure who took the Franks from a marginal group in war-torn, unstable northern Gaul to the rulers of almost all of the old Roman region during his reign. The Franks, like the other barbarian groups we've discussed over the last several episodes, began as more or less a Roman army operating amid the disintegration of the Roman state. Under the leadership of a series of warlords that culminated in the rise of Clovis, the Franks moved from the periphery of the Roman world to the very center. That incident we began with is revealing. It's the behavior of a frontier general, a warlord par excellence, not a cultivated Roman aristocrat. In the rise of the Franks, we see them bringing the culture and the violence of the frontier, the environment that produced savvy, ruthless warlords, to what had once been the interior, peaceful core of the Roman world. As they did this, the Franks established a series of kingdoms that gave modern-day France its name, and these kingdoms provided the basis for the eventual state of Charles Martel, his grandson Charlemagne, and their Carolingian successors, and from there all the way through to modern-day France. By the time of the Crusades, Frank had become a generic term for a Westerner, reflecting the increasing dominance of the Western Franks over the political, social, and cultural life of Western Europe and beyond. All of that started with a barbarian group living along the fringes of the Roman Empire. To grasp the transformation the Franks wrought on the Roman provinces of Gaul, we'll follow the story of a family from the northern reaches of that region as the Franks moved from the periphery to the interior and changed Gaul to Francia. I'm Patrick Wyman, and this is The Fall of Rome. We've already covered the Franks a little bit back in this show, back in Episode 7, The Three Transformations of Roman Gaul. In that episode, I talked about the divergent paths that the various regions of Gaul took as the Roman Empire fell apart, with the southeast, Provence basically, changing only slowly and over the course of centuries, the southwest, where the Visigoths settled, shifting a bit more under barbarian rule, but still maintaining the same basic outlines of life that had gone on before, and finally, northern Gaul, which went through serious disruptions as early as the end of the 4th century. The Franks emerged from this last region, from a northern Gaul where effective central government was more or less gone by the year 430 or so, and the line between the barbarian world and the Roman was growing blurred to the point where the two were becoming indistinguishable from one another. They were blending into something coherent, a frontier culture of its own. Exactly what happened here between the end of the 4th century, when imperial rule was already starting to fall apart, and the beginning of the 6th, when Clovis and the Franks began to emerge as the most dominant force, is really, really hard to say in any sort of detail. It's even more difficult here than it is for most places in this period, which aren't exactly overflowing with the kind of source material we use to construct a coherent narrative of what was going on. What we do have are scattered glimpses into the world of 5th century Northern Gaul, occasional puddles of light thrown into a narrative landscape of pitch-black darkness. Reconstructing anything like a cohesive political sequence of events is a fool's errand, though we'll do what we can to provide some sort of logical order and structure to the information that's available to us. So let's talk a little bit about our sources here. The major source for the early history of the Franks comes from the author I already mentioned, Bishop Gregory of Tours, who wrote in the closing decades of the 6th century. A lot of older histories of the early years of what eventually became the Frankish kingdom basically recapitulate what he said, but that's a huge error. Gregory was pretty shaky even on Clovis, who died less than 30 years before Gregory was born, and he was way shakier on what had happened before that. There are a few other textual sources, some of them contemporary, most of them not, which do tell us a bit about the 5th century, and we'll try to use them judiciously. For the 5th and into the 6th centuries, our most important source is actually archaeology, and this sheds light not so much on the Franks themselves as on the world that surrounded them and produced the Frankish army that eventually led to this kingdom. Remember, the things that we find in the ground don't really tell us about the ethnicity of their owners. But let's take a step back here and focus on the Franks themselves. Who were they? Well, the Franks pop up in the sources around the same time as the other major barbarian groupings that would trouble the Roman Empire in its last couple of centuries, during the crisis of the 3rd century. They weren't a new group of people arrived on the frontier from elsewhere, as the Goths may have been, but they were what seems like a confederation, a new political assemblage of the tribes that had already been living along the Lower Rhine in what's now the Netherlands and northwestern Germany for quite some time. The first reference to the Franks comes from the 260s, when a Roman marching song recorded in a later source celebrated the deaths of thousands of Franks in a battle, and they show up a few times as raiders and invaders during the ongoing collapse of the frontiers in the 3rd century. After that, the Franks pop up repeatedly throughout the 4th century as foes of the empire. The Emperor Julian fought them throughout the 350s, and there were conflicts in the 380s as well. Occasionally, we see them as allies, and tens of thousands of individual Franks joined the Roman army. Many of those recruits rose to high positions, including Magister Militum, Supreme General in the West. If you think back to episode 10 of this show, the one on the Roman army, the character that we followed, Arbogastes, was a Frank born along the frontier who joined the military as a teenager. That was a typical story for this time. Some groups of Franks were settled in the Roman Empire as allies, including the Salians, just to the west of the mouth of the Rhine in the modern-day Netherlands and northern Belgium, and it was to this group that eventually gave us Clovis and then the Kingdom of the Franks. It's unwise to focus too much on these insignificant Salians at this point, though, and as the 4th century turned into the 5th, distinctions between Romans and Franks along the northern stretch of the Rhine frontier start to get a little more confused. We have only the most scattered textual references as to what was happening here, and they're basically useless if we try to construct some sort of coherent narrative out of them. Instead, we turn to archaeology. There are plentiful and well-excavated archaeological remains from this period and this region, especially cemeteries, which pop up in increasing numbers in the late 4th and early 5th centuries. These cemeteries follow a characteristic form. They consist of well-ordered graves in rows, and the people in these graves were often buried with weapons and other rich grave goods. They wore distinctive belt buckles and brooches on the clothes they wore that they carried into death. These cemeteries and their distinctive occupants appear all over northern Gaul, concentrated between the Seine and the Rhine, with only a few of them showing up on the east side of the Rhine. Now, traditionally, historians and archaeologists have interpreted these cemeteries as evidence of Germanic-speaking settlers, namely Franks, seeping eastward across the Rhine into Roman territory. These were either invaders or more likely Roman soldiers of Germanic origin, according to the particular interpretation you give these within this broad heading. But this is a bad explanation, and I'll tell you why. First of all, this burial rite, rows of graves with weapons burials and distinctive clothing markers, barely existed on the far side of the Rhine. There's nothing to suggest that it was an importation from outside the empire. Instead, this burial rite was the product of the transformation of northern Gaul in the 4th and into the 5th centuries. After the crisis of the 3rd century, when the frontiers collapsed and the empire nearly fractured into oblivion, What emerged was a more militarized and authoritarian empire, with a more powerful army and more static, fortified frontiers. No region better captures this transformation of the empire than Northern Gaul, precisely the region where we begin to see these new cemeteries with their weapons burials and rich grave goods. In the second and into the beginning of the third centuries, at the height of the empire's wealth, prosperity, and population, Northern Gaul hadn't really been all that different from other provinces. A little poorer, maybe a little less densely populated, but characteristically Roman with its towns, cities, and rural villas. The repeated invasions and accompanying withdrawal of state power in the crisis of the 3rd century was a disaster for Northern Gaul. The population drastically diminished, villas were abandoned or destroyed, and as elsewhere in the Roman world, cities and towns were left with far fewer people. While the frontier itself, the places directly facing the barbarian world, had always been militarized, this started to extend into the interior of Northern Gaul as well. Cities, as elsewhere in the Roman world, acquired stout walls, ditches, and other defensive measures. Some places that had been purely urban, meaning civilian, during the High Empire either became purely military or acquired a major military facet, like a weapons factory at Amiens. Large forts complete with garrisons of troops popped up in the countryside. Especially close to the frontier, hilltops were turned into fortifications, some of them probably official and others built by local authorities or strong leaders. This was, in other words, a militarized landscape, increasingly so. Soldiers were everywhere in Northern Gaul in the 4th century. As we've discussed many times over the course of this show, the late Roman army was filled with men born along and beyond the frontier, and as an institution, it had its own culture, norms, and even language that separated it from civilian society. The army was the primary social and cultural force along the frontier, the Roman institution with which the barbarians interacted and to which they assimilated. What happened in Northern Gaul in the 4th century wasn't weapon-bearing Germanic barbarians seeping into the region from across the frontier. What we're seeing instead with these cemeteries and fortifications is military culture taking over an entire region from the ground up. What's notable is that it wasn't just soldiers doing the militarizing. Military culture bled into civilian culture and transformed it. Weapons became status symbols, and local aristocrats copied military dress and fashion. Houses started to look like forts, and local aristocrats built fortified places for themselves. It wasn't Frankish immigrants who did this, though they had a role to play. It was local Romans adopting new cultural norms and values imported to the interior from the frontier and the army that ran it. I want to stop here to introduce the characters in our story. We're going to follow a family, initially a Roman family, as they experienced the changes of Northern Gaul in the 4th and the 5th centuries, in which the Franks played an enormous role. We'll start with the family patriarch, and we'll call him Valerius Eustace, which is actually a real name recorded on a tombstone in Amiens in northern France from this period. Now, our friend Valerius, not the guy on the tombstone, wasn't from Northern Gaul. He was a retired soldier from Illyria in the Balkans, a cavalry officer who ended his career at a small post in Northern Gaul around the year 360. Valerius could have returned to Illyria when his time was up, but like so many soldiers who had put in their 20 or more years in the late Roman military, home was the army, not some long-forgotten farm half a world away. He'd been posted here in Northern Gaul for around 15 years, shuttling from one fort or city garrison or outpost to the next between Amiens and the Rhine. Like so many other soldiers, Valerius had married a local woman at one of these posts near Tournai in present-day Belgium, and it was to her and to her family that he returned when his time in the army was up. Land was what Valerius wanted, and he used plunder accumulated from expeditions across the frontier or taken from Frankish or Alemanni raiders he'd caught on this side of the Rhine. That plunder, plus his retirement bonus, went into setting up Valerius as a local landowner with a small villa of his own. Now, our friend Valerius was a military man, and nobody's fool. Raiders from across the frontier often got as far as Tournai, so his villa, more a farmhouse, would be utilitarian and defensible. He put it up on a small hill with a view of the surrounding countryside, and enclosed it with a strong stone wall 10 feet high, giving the house a distinctly military character in keeping with Valerius' personality and the stark discipline he'd picked up in the legions. Around this villa were fields where Valerius's tenants grew wheat and millet, raised horses and cattle, and made some pottery. Some of that was consumed locally, but more of it was destined for the omnipresent army and its voracious material needs. Much of what he sent to the army in food or livestock was tax, but the rest of it was commercial. That was how Valerius and other landowners in northern Gaul acquired coin. The army was the main fiscal driver in this whole region, and Valerius maintained close connections with the commanders and supply officers of the various forts, outposts, and city garrisons in a 50-mile radius around his farmhouse. His prosperity depended on those personal and commercial relationships. So this was the life Valerius and his family built. He had three children who survived to adulthood, two daughters and a son. The son, Lucius, followed his father into the military around the year 375 and was posted as the commander of a cavalry unit along the frontier, engaging in the familiar cycle of boring garrison duty, occasional expeditions into the barbarian lands, and frequent patrols to sweep up the steady diet of Frankish raiders who snuck into Roman territory to fight and steal. Most of Lucius's troops and his cavalry unit were Franks themselves, and he soon picked up the Frankish language and some of their habits. He always wore trousers, and his soldiers' Latin was generously spiced with Frankish loanwords. Valerius's two daughters married men in the vicinity of his farmhouse, one the son of a fellow small landowner who likewise did most of his business with the army, and the other an army officer in command of a local garrison. This was how the local elites of northern Gaul, men like Valerius, helped to embed themselves and their families in the social fabric and tied themselves to the institutional structures of the army. After all, wouldn't Valerius's army officer's son-in-law rather do business with family, with Valerius and with his other brother-in-law, the landowner? When Valerius died around 380, he was buried in a style that was becoming increasingly common in the region. His son, Lucius, home from his posting on the frontier for the funeral, made sure that Valerius was buried with his favorite sword clasped in his hands. The buckle on Valerius's belt was a wide, fancy one of military type, with a delicate, intricate pattern chip-carved into the copper, and the brooch that pinned the cloak he wore into the coffin was likewise of military design, with two equal arms extending out from the pin, what archaeologists call a crossbow brooch. These were the kinds of items a high-ranking military officer would wear, and to Lucius, as well as to Valerius's other relatives and business associates who were there for the funeral, these were the items that would show what an important person Valerius had been in life. Even as a civilian, 20 years out of the army, Valerius still felt like a soldier. Increasingly, the people who lived in northern Gaul associated status with weapons and the other markers of military rank. These days, I don't have as much time as I'd like to sit down with a good book. Luckily, Audible makes it possible for me to catch up with everything I want to read thanks to its unmatched selection of audiobooks and other audio content. This week, I'm recommending A Distant Mirror, The Calamitous 14th Century by Barbara Tuchman. It's one of the great works of popular narrative history I've ever read, a deep and entertaining look at a disastrous century of famine, war, plague, and madness. Now, like me, you may not have much time to read, but whether you're driving the baby to daycare, walking the dog, hitting up the treadmill, you have time for an audiobook. Enjoy books in a whole new way. Listen anywhere, anytime. Try Audible for free by texting AUDIBLE to 28325. That's AUDIBLE, Audible, to 28325. One more time, try Audible for free by texting Audible to 28325. Give Audible a try. If you like this show, you'll love what you find on Audible.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Lucius went back to his post on the frontier after the funeral, trusting his sisters, their husbands, and his mother to run the family estate until he finished his term of service. After the chaos of the 350s, when huge Frankish and Alemanni invasions had cut a swath of destruction through northern Gaul, these were relatively quiet years. The army, with officers like Lucius and the troops under his command, did a pretty good job of keeping trouble contained along the frontier. In fact, the ties between Franks on the far side of the Rhine and Romans like Lucius grew closer. Alliances were struck, Roman cash subsidized barbarian kings, and Lucius married the daughter of a Frankish chieftain. The only momentary trouble came when a British usurper named Magnus Maximus brought his army to Gaul in the 380s and defeated the Emperor Gratian in battle near Paris, who was killed shortly thereafter. That lasted only a few years, though, and really, what was the difference between a usurper in Gaul and an emperor in Italy? You paid the same taxes either way. By the 390s, though, things were getting a bit hotter. Whole units of the army had been stripped away from the Rhine garrisons to fight in a civil war in Italy between Theodosius and the usurper in the west. After the civil war, the western army had been devastated, and the troops that returned to their garrison were much reduced. Those alliances that officers like Lucius had struck with Frankish kings and chieftains grew rather more important, and whole segments of the frontier were effectively trusted to them for defense rather than to regular army units. There simply weren't enough of them. The Salians, the group of Franks who would eventually form the foundation of Clovis's kingdom, were probably one of these Frankish factions. When Lucius returned home from the frontier around 395, he was growing concerned about the increasing instability of the frontier. The Alemanni were testing the southern reaches around Strasbourg, and he'd heard that seafaring Saxons were hitting the coasts of Britain and of Gaul. Enterprising groups of Saxons were even moving up the rivers and striking targets inland. Frankish raiders were sneaking across the Rhine into the gaps left by depleted units of the army. Even Tournai, 160 miles from the frontier, give or take, was in danger. Those depleted or departed units of the army hadn't just left the frontier. They had also left the interior forts and garrisons around cities like Tournai, leaving them less able to deal with these incursions when they happened. Lucius didn't leave behind his family's legacy of military service or his own inclinations when he got out of the army. He was a fighter in an increasingly militarized culture, and he wasn't going to let barbarian raiders ravage his land or burn down his house. Lucius, remember, had married the daughter of a Frankish chieftain. His cavalry troop had been full of Franks. Why not bring some Franks, men who had served in his father-in-law's warband, with him? There was plenty of land around Tournai on which to plant these professional warriors, even if coin was growing increasingly scarce. They could man some of the fortifications that the departed army had left behind, which were completely unused. This was an elegant solution that occurred naturally to a northern Gallic society steeped in the social world of the military and the frontier. The other landowners around Tournai, and across the region more generally, were starting to do the same thing. They were no longer building old-style villas with mosaic floors and bathhouses. They were building fortified compounds on hilltops, and they were building watchtowers. Some of them were bringing in Franks or Saxons or retired soldiers to defend their lands. Even those who'd never served in the army were carrying weapons and wearing military-style belts, brooches, and clothing, and when they were buried, they took those items with them into death as status markers. Interestingly enough, those old-school historians and archaeologists who assumed burial with those things was a Germanic custom imported to northern Gaul had it exactly backwards. This was a form of status display that grew up in northern Gaul, and if anything, it was exported from there to the Frankish, Alemanni, and Saxon lands beyond the Rhine. These contacts went both directions. Romans from the region served in the army and, like Lucius, married Frankish women. Franks served in the Roman army and moved into Roman territory, either as allies like the Salians, or as individuals or groups working for landowners. In other words, the culture and society that had initially grown up in the military outposts right along the frontier was increasingly extending deep into northern Gaul itself. It's not a coincidence that this was happening right as the central Roman government was losing its grasp on the region. For a few years, Lucius and his newly arrived Franks kept a peace in the vicinity of their land. Lucius had a number of sons and daughters at this point, all of whom had grown up speaking both Latin and their mother's Frankish tongue during their youthful years along the frontier. One daughter married the son of another landowner in the area of Tournai, thereby increasing Lucius's family's reach, and another married the leader of the Frankish contingent he'd brought back from beyond the Rhine, who eventually returned back to his homeland with his wife. Now the eldest son, Eustace, joined the military and was assigned to a frontier garrison right on the edge of the Frankish lands, near the land his Frankish grandfather had controlled before his death. Eustace's family contacts in that region served him well. His uncle, the new chieftain, he was actually calling himself a king now, was still formally allied to the Romans. By this point, though, how formal really were those connections? Eustace wasn't the only Roman army officer to whom this Frankish king was related by blood. Defending the frontier on both sides was starting to look more like a family business than bilateral treaties between formal parties. In addition to his uncle, the Frankish king, Eustace's family and her husband, now an important Frankish war leader in his own right, were another familial connection beyond the Rhine. In other words, this was a region that was being drawn together by ties of trade, by ties of profession, by ties of blood. Now, this state of affairs held until 406, when a great invading force of Vandals, Alans, and Sueves broke through the Rhine defenses and cut a swath of destruction through Gaul. Lucius gathered up his Frankish soldiers and tenants and joined up with Eustace, the remnants of the regular army, and the allied Franks on both sides of the Rhine. They did their best to contain the invading barbarians along the frontier, but it wasn't enough. Lucius was killed, so was his younger son, and so too was Eustace's uncle, the Frankish king, in a great battle, though they extracted the death of the Vandal king as the price of their resistance. Eustace barely escaped, retreating into the deep forest of the Ardennes to harry the Vandals, Alans, and Sueves as they ravaged the countryside of northern Gaul. The family lands around Tournai were ravaged, and along with many other towns and cities in the region. If not for the arrival in 408 of the British general and usurping emperor Constantine III, along with the remnants of the British field army, all might have been lost. Eustace and his troops, along with their remaining Frankish allies, joined up with the newly arrived general to pen up the invaders in a corner of northern Gaul. Eventually, though, Constantine III's designs on imperial power got the better of him. The invaders headed south, leaving behind a war-torn and depleted region. While Constantine III was technically in charge, and even reopened the imperial mint at Trier, along the frontier, when he departed, imperial authority left northern Gaul more or less for good. So what was left in northern Gaul after the Vandals, Alans, and Sueves made their way south and snuck across the Pyrenees to Spain? Well, imperial authority, as I said, was pretty much gone. The regular army wasn't much of a presence anymore. The pay in coin had stopped coming from the south when Constantine III had taken over, and it came only occasionally after he was defeated and executed. Eustace had returned to the frontier when the barbarians departed, but it wasn't the same. Troops don't fight if they're not getting paid, and while the supply officers could still coordinate to bring in tax revenue in kind, things like livestock, grain, beer, clothing, and other essentials, actual coin was starting to be in real short supply. We genuinely don't know much about what happened in northern Gaul over the next 50 or so years, but we can do a bit of well-founded speculating on the basis of the archaeological evidence. The frontier that separated the two sides of the Rhine, and therefore the Franks from the Romans of northern Gaul, essentially ceased to exist. The kinds of relationships Valerius, Eustace, and his family had struck with the chieftains and kings on the far side of the Rhine grew in scope and meaning, to the point in the late 450s where Eustace's grandson, Paulus, was just as comfortable operating in Frankish as he was in Latin. There wasn't much cultural difference between him, technically a Roman warlord, and a Frankish warlord. This Paulus, and apologies for skipping some time here, commanded Franks and Romans with equal facility. His sister was married to a king of the Salian Franks around the mouth of the Rhine, and his son was married to a daughter of a Roman general, a man named Aegidius, who'd been a close associate and general under the great Aetius. After the accession of the new emperor Majorian in 457, Aegidius was promoted to Magister Militum, supreme general, at least on paper, in Gaul. By this time, the family's influence and power had grown. Paulus thought of himself as Roman, a Roman aristocrat. But to be a Roman aristocrat in northern Gaul at this point was to be a military man, was to be effectively a warlord. Like his great-grandfather and grandfather before him, Paulus wore a wide, decorative belt with a dagger and a sword hanging from it. He carried an axe. He wore a red military cloak pinned with a decorative brooch over his armor. He lived in the same fortified house his great-grandfather had built, though it was expanded and more strongly defended, more like a fort than a farmhouse. Paulus and his extended family network of Frankish kings and chieftains, Roman landholders, and generals holding official or semi-official positions were the very upper crust of this militarized northern Gallic society. Compared to the great aristocrats of southern Gaul, much less Italy, with their fancy villas and their mosaics and their bathhouses and their libraries stocked full of priceless literary works, Paulus and his kin were practically impoverished. There was practically no coinage and not much trade except in barter. There was little manufacture or industry. Land and movable plunder were the only real wealth in this world. From our perspective, as historians looking backward, it's not an exaggeration to say that the economy had collapsed completely. This was only a little more mild version of what had happened in Britain 25 or so years earlier. While wealth of the kind that was still common in the Mediterranean stretches of the Roman Empire was non-existent here in northern Gaul, there was military power and plenty of it. Whether he thought of himself this way or not, Paulus was effectively a petty strongman, a warlord. He commanded soldiers, whom he paid in plunder and coin when he could get it. He worked to bring more land under his control, tried to recruit more troops, and alternately allied with and fought other Roman landowners and encroaching Franks alike. As violent as this sounds, and it was also basically stable. The kinds of lavishly furnished burials of our first character here, Valerius, and his son Lucius, who was killed in that great invasion of 406, became increasingly less common after 425 or so. That might have been because of less wealth to put in the ground, but I'd also say it's because, by this point, this world of endemic violence had acquired its ruling families, its new military aristocrats, whether they were of Roman descent or Frankish. When Paulus buried his father, he didn't need to bury him with gold and a fancy belt and a fine sword. Everybody knew he was a big man, and that Paulus was too. Nobody in the community needed a reminder in the form of one of those furnished burials. Northern Gaul had become a playground for warlords, from small fry like Paulus to the great ones like Aegidius. This was a poorer world, a more militarized world, and a more violent one. It was, for all intents and purposes, the frontier. Slowly but surely, the militarized and barbarized relationships of the frontier had seeped westward, covering first the mouth of the Rhine, then the area around Tournai, and finally stretching all the way to Paris and then to the Loire River. The rise of the Frankish kingdom is in essence the story of how one kind of warlord, a Frankish king, beat out all of his competitors. It's to these great warlords and how they interacted with each other that we'll turn next.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation. and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
Now, I mentioned a fella named Aegidius in that last segment, and in our hypothetical reconstruction here, his daughter is married to our friend Pallas' son. This Aegidius is an interesting character. He probably came from an aristocratic family around the city of Lyon in central Gaul, and while we know little about his early career, it seems fairly certain that he came to power with the rise of Aetius, and then especially with the accession of Majorian as emperor in 457. Now, Aegidius' career goes hand in hand with that of another warlord, a Frank named Childeric, who commanded the Salian Franks in northern Gaul. Who were these Salian Franks, and who was Childeric? Well, traditionally, these Franks have been seen as barbarians settled in Roman territory by treaty, who fought as allies of the Romans. Childeric, in this telling, was a pretty straightforward barbarian king, who ruled the Salian Franks as one of the first members of the Merovingian dynasty, so-called because of its legendary founder, Merovec, who's supposed to be Childeric's father. But if the portrait of northern Gaul I gave you in that last segment is anything close to correct, this situation was nowhere near this straightforward. The Salian Franks weren't a homogeneous ethnic group. They were one power block, one army, in a fractured landscape filled with warlords and their subordinate armies. They were integrated into the society of northern Gaul through the marriages of the great and the powerful with other petty and greater warlords, men like our friend Paulus. The Salian Franks had been on this side of the Rhine for at least a century, if not longer, and this was a long time to acclimate to and become part of this already militarized society in northern Gaul. They exerted a strong influence, to be sure, but it makes more sense to think of this as a fractious, militarized region full of soldiers and warlords. Some Franks, some Romans, but all more like each other than they were outsiders. This kind of environment is the only way to explain an otherwise puzzling anecdote. Gregory of Tours, the historian I mentioned at the very beginning of this episode, tells us that Aegidius replaced Childeric as king of the Salian Franks for 8 years. Wait, what? How could a Roman general become king of the Franks? If we think of the Franks as a barbarian people, as outsiders with their own practices and a foreign culture, then this is hard to square. But if we think of the Franks as part and parcel of this northern Gallic military society, in fact, as the or one of the field armies of what remained of the Roman state here in the north, then Aegidius replacing Childeric was just one semi-independent warlord replacing another at the head of an army. It's likely that Aegidius had a long, pre-existing relationship with these Franks, and rather than looking at the Franks as a barbarian kingdom in the making, they were a multi-ethnic army like the Visigoths or the other groups that we've discussed. So why does this matter? Well, you see, Aegidius struck out on his own after the Emperor Majorian, the man who'd appointed him as supreme general in Gaul, was murdered. Aegidius refused to accept Majorian's successor as legitimate, and with an army of Franks at his back, and maybe working under the title of King of the Franks, he acted as his own independent force in the region. The new emperor, Severus, engaged the Goths to go after Aegidius, but he thrashed them at Orléans. He killed Frederick, the brother of the Gothic king, in the process. It seems likely that the Goths were trying to push north to or beyond the Loire River, what was effectively the boundary between wild northern Gaul and settled southern Gaul, and that Aegidius was working to stop them. This is a good deal south of the region that we've been discussing over the course of this episode, and Aegidius' actions here and in what will follow, we can see the kind of military frontier culture we've been discussing steadily pushing further and further away from the Rhine and into the interior of Gaul. Our friend Paulus was along for the ride. After all, his son will call him Clodio, a Frankish name indicative of the increasingly close ties between Franks and Romans in the north, was married to Aegidius' daughter. This wasn't just a family tie, but a military alliance between the private army that Paulus had at his disposal and Aegidius' field army. Rather than staying in the family lands around Tournai, Paulus spent most of his life in the saddle, marching here and fighting there on his own behalf and on that of his ally Aegidius. Aegidius died in 464 or 465. We're not sure how. It may have been murder or poison or even the plague, but it's impossible to say for sure. When he died, Childeric returned from exile and took over once again as king of the Franks. He took over leadership of this army. This may have put Paulus, or presumably the other local warlords who'd closely been allied with Aegidius, in a tough situation. After all, they'd presumably supported Aegidius when Kilderic was on the outs. We have no real idea. Now, Pallas' son Clodio had grown up surrounded by soldiers, most of them Franks, and whatever his father had thought, he had no problem accepting Kilderic as king. He may even have thought of himself as a Frank by this point. The lines were increasingly blurred. Kilderic wasn't the only potential warlord here, though. There was also our friend Clodio's brother-in-law, the son of Aegidius, Syagrius. This Syagrius set up shop in the city of Soissons in the north and seems to have been a king himself. Gregory of Tours calls him Rex Romanorum, the king of the Romans, and in an environment where warlords with armies at their back called themselves kings. Kilderic, the Visigothic kings, Burgundian kings, Frankish kings along the Rhine. Why not Syagrius, too? Now, we need to be careful with Syagrius. We know very, very little about him or what he ruled as Rex Romanorum, aside from the fact that his kingdom was apparently centered on Soissons, but a great many modern historians have made him out to be a great power in the region with a coherent realm, a rump state of the Roman Empire stretching from Brittany to Verdun. That's entirely possible, but I think it's a drastic overreading of the evidence that we actually have available to us. Instead, I'd say it's more likely that northern Gaul was full of independent warlords with more or less defined bases whose territory probably overlapped and over which they clashed regularly. There was Arbogastes, the Count of Trier along the old frontier, with whom our old friend Sidonius Apollinaris corresponded. There were Alamanni operating as far west as Troyes. There was a Count Paulus exercising some authority with an army around the Loire. There was a recently arrived Riothamus, king of the Britons, in Armorica on the northwest Atlantic coast. There was Kilderic running around with an army of Franks between Paris, the Loire River, and the far reaches of northern Gaul, like Tournai, where our family that we've been talking about was based. And there was Syagrius around Soissons. Our sources for this region around this time are so bad that this is about the extent of what we know, and I'd guess that these gentlemen were hardly alone in fitting this template of Romano-barbarian warlord. What defined them was command of an army in some territory, and the extent of their control probably fluctuated. All of their armies presumably included large numbers of Franks. Around 481, give or take 5 years, Kilderic, king of the Franks, died. He left behind a son, whom we know as Clovis. His real name in Frankish was something more like Chlodovig, but he's the towering figure with whom we began this episode. Clovis buried Kilderic lavishly near the city of Tournai in what's now Belgium, where we've spent a lot of time in this episode. Now, Clovis stocked Kilderic's tomb with gold and a wide array of decorative items, including a ring, famously, that bore the inscription Kilderici Regis, of Kilderic the King. Now, later excavators also found a bunch of horses interred around the tomb as well, and it's possible that these were animal sacrifices buried at the same time as this deceased Frankish king. There was a good reason that Clovis buried Kilderic with such riches, and in Tournai, which was far to the north of where Kilderic had spent most of his career. Why not bury him around Paris? Why waste all these resources by putting them in the ground with a dead man? It's simple. Instability, according to a dang fine historian by the name of Guy Housel, whose explanations of these things I'd say make the most sense. Kilderic was by all accounts a real player in this fractured, violent landscape, and while we know Clovis would go on to be an able, ruthless, and accomplished king, nobody could have known that in 481 or so. He may only have been a teenager at this point. In an environment stocked with seasoned warlords like Syagrius, Arbogastes, and our hypothetical friend Clodio, it wasn't a given that Clovis would be successful or even succeed his father. Tournai was well outside Kilderic's normal area of operation, as far as we know, but it was smack dab in the center of what by this point had become the Frankish heartland. Generations of interactions between Franks and Roman families like the one that we followed today had transformed that territory and the people who lived there. By this point, like I said earlier, our friend Clodio may well have considered himself a Frank. After all, he was a soldier. Soldiers were Franks. Franks were soldiers. He'd spent his entire life surrounded by Franks. And by this point, too, the Franks weren't migrants. They were just as native to this region as Clodio and his family had been. And they were all, most importantly, participants in a common military culture that they all shared. So if Tournai was now the Frankish heartland, it made sense for Clovis to bury his father there. It was a way of staking a claim on the loyalty of the Franks writ large, not just on Kilderic's army. Remember, Aegidius, Syagrius' father, had likewise held command of that army for a while. It wasn't a given that Syagrius couldn't swoop in and displace Clovis just as his father had done to Childeric. There were also at least two other kings of the Franks. By burying Childeric in this spot, with all of this wealth, Clovis was essentially planting his flag as the rightful king of the Franks, in contradiction to the other two, who were his relatives but weren't necessarily friendly. If he could afford to bury his father like this, and to do so in such a way as to bind himself to the important people in this world, people like our friend Clodio and the other petty warlords, then Clovis was effectively saying that he was a force to be taken seriously. Priority number one for Clovis was dealing with Syagrius, and if we see Syagrius not as just another warlord in northern Gaul, but as a potential rival for leadership of the Franks, then Clovis' single-minded devotion to dealing with him suddenly makes a lot more sense. The exact chronology is confused. We have basically no idea when things happened in Clovis' reign until the year 500 or even after. But sometime after 484 and before 491, Clovis succeeded in driving Syagrius out of Soissons. Syagrius fled south to the court of Alaric II in Toulouse, and Clovis was willing to fight a war with the powerful Visigoths in order to secure the return of Syagrius as a prisoner. When Alaric II handed him over, Clovis immediately executed him. The only way that all of this makes sense is if he wasn't just a rival warlord, but a rival for leadership of the Franks. Now this was just the beginning for Clovis. He raided south into Visigothic territory on several occasions. He intervened in a Burgundian civil war around 500. He married his sister to the Ostrogothic king Theodoric, and he thrashed the Alemanni in 506. It was around this time that Clovis started to make legitimately threatening moves to the south against the Visigoths, something that Theodoric the Great, that Ostrogothic king that we talked about in the last episode, he tried to forestall with some deft diplomacy. It was all to no avail. In 507, Clovis allied with another one of those Frankish kings, a fellow named Sigebert the Lame, and headed south with a major army. He met the Visigothic king, Alaric II, in battle at Vouillet and thrashed him, killing Alaric II, maybe by his own hand, according to one account, and he drove the Visigoths out of Gaul for good. Clovis wasn't done yet, though. He put forth a code of laws, the Salic Laws, and he convened councils of bishops after converting to the Orthodox brand of Christianity. He dealt cunningly with those remaining Frankish kings, that Sigebert the Lame who'd been his ally. He won over their leaders, and then he killed them one by one until he was the last king of the Franks left standing. Our friend Clodio and the rest of his extended family would have been part and parcel of this. Though in our hypothetical reconstruction, Syagrius was his brother-in-law, his family's connections to Childeric, Clovis, and this particular Frankish army went back decades. Clovis must have been a compelling figure even in his youth to inspire this kind of support from seasoned, grizzled soldiers molded by generations of endemic violence. For what it's worth, it wasn't just men of violence who threw in their lot with Clovis. The Bishop of Reims, St. Remigius, sent Clovis a letter congratulating him for taking over his father's administration of Gallia Belgica. What a phrase, what a way of talking about what's effectively a warlord. At least in Remigius's mind, Clovis could still be slotted into a long disused political framework. To some audiences, at least, he could still be seen as a provincial governor. And we don't know much about the internal workings of this Frankish kingdom, aside from the fact that they did engage in some taxation. But let's think back to the anecdote with which we began this episode, Clovis splitting that man's head in two over a prior offense. If Gregory's story is to be believed, and I really do think it captures something essential about this world, then it tells us that leadership was personal. Warlords didn't really rule through institutions and state structures, though they may have made use of them, like taxes. They put themselves front and center and did their own dirty work. Ruthlessness and a will to violence aren't mutually exclusive with intelligence and political savvy, either, and Clovis must have had all of these in spades, especially if he could also convince men like Bishop Remigius, no fool that guy, that he could also be seen as a Roman governor. Men like our hypothetical friend Clodio, this mixed Frankish-Roman aristocracy that grew out of this militarized environment, weren't pushovers. There was no room in this world for a soft leader. A successful king had to be a warlord, a product of this militarized frontier culture that had slowly but surely seeped from the borders of the Roman Empire into the interior. By the time he died around 511, Clovis was the preeminent warlord and king in Gaul. His kingdom split into four parts on his death, with each slice going to a different son. Soon, they'd eject the Burgundians from their small kingdom, take over Gaul completely, and intervene in the Gothic Wars in Italy. Gaul was, by this point, well on its way to becoming Francia, but that's a story for another time. In the next episode, we'll cross the English Channel for the island of Britain to continue on with our discussion of the barbarian successor states. The famous Anglo-Saxons, the bringers of the English language, the source of the great Beowulf story, and their many quarrelsome kingdoms will be our subject. Thank you very much for joining me for today's episode. If you have a spare moment, I'd appreciate it if you left a rating and a review. And if you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. You can follow me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. If you have questions, comments, or concerns, or if you just want to chat a bit about the fall of the Roman Empire, feel free to drop me a line anytime. If you'd like to help me out even a bit more, I'd really appreciate it if you took the survey at wondery.com/survey. Thanks for listening. Until next time, this has been The Fall of Rome.